Part of the Boundless Audio Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Whining About Herstory, the women's... the women's... My brain is not working.
We've only been doing this for 5 years. It's fine.
It's the anger.
Inside me. Kelly has had a day.
I've had a day.
We've all had the last 20 minutes.
We've all kind of had a day. The Women's History Podcast. We're two longtime besties with breasties. Drink some wine, finally. Because we haven't been drinking wine for a while, I feel like. I mean, like, we didn't. And then I think the last two episodes we did, but then we did a live show where we didn't.
Well, yeah, because the last episode I was drinking water. I think you might have been drinking a little.
Probably
you
water.
Might have been drinking some wine or water. And then we did the live show where we were like just, we were just tweaking on coffee.
But we do have wine today.
Thank you, God.
And yeah, we whine about women from history that you probably haven't heard of, but definitely should have. And I'm Kelly.
And I'm Emily. And I think today's going to be a good episode because
we're a bit spicy today.
We're punchy. We're spicy like my throw up.
It's related to a story we were just talking about.
A story we were literally talking about less than a minute ago.
Yeah, like literally right before we hit the record button.
Like, honestly, I know y'all weren't there, but that was a perfect callback.
Yes,
you
it
just
was.
Can't appreciate. So Kelly, tell us about the wine we're drinking.
I picked out a wine called Troublemaker with a very, very basic like label. Like for us, we like labels, but it's just like a red label, but it's like torn. And where it's torn is where it says Troublemaker.
It's very dramatic and I love it.
It's by a man named Austin Hope. But it says, Troublemaker is a wink and a nod to the early days when young Austin Hope was sent to the vineyards for breaking the rules and making mischief. Who knew a childhood punishment could become a lifelong passion and career? Still stirring things up, Troublemaker is all about breaking the rules. The way we see it, rules restrict our ability to create and innovate. Troublemaker wine is not bound by any perceptions of what a good wine should be. It's a wine made for you and your inner troublemaker.
I love that. Also, I can totally relate because he got punished by being sent out to the vineyards for being trouble.
Like, fuck that.
And then he like... create a passion. I also have a passion for sitting in my room for long periods of time speaking to no one.
Exactly.
I constantly put myself in a timeout. I'm like, can I have a timeout? Everyone go away, please.
Yeah. So it's a red blend from Central Coast, California.
Right smack dab in the middle.
I'd say we can cheers, but the cheers is going to be sad and pathetic because we have plastic wine glasses.
We are drinking out of our whining crime fucking patriarchy wine glasses, and they are plastic. So it's a spiritual clink.
Yeah.
All right.
Here's to troublemaking.
Here's to troublemaking and the trouble we made at our live show.
Yeah.
So sad. We didn't even try. I think I was afraid of spilling.
I was afraid of it like, because it's not going to break, but I was afraid of it like bending and then like spilling.
I was afraid of like, you know, when I've done it with too much gusto and the wine like flies up into the air and there's that moment where we're both praying to all of the deities that's going to go directly back in the glass.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, Emily.
So,
you get to start us off.
I have a say their name that ties into our story. So, because it's Women's History Month, I've really been trying to focus on stories that are like really speak to me, where it's like, I want to have a personal connection or I want to learn about something that I have a personal interest in. So, naturally, I was Googling women and crows. And after I started refining my search, to not just be like a bunch of goth MySpace girls with crows and that kind of thing, I actually found this amazing story. So, Seattle girl befriends neighborhood crows, making bird lovers everywhere jealous.
Like, I wouldn't even consider myself a bird lover. I'm like, I'm a crow and raven lover. And
I was volunteering today and I asked the guy, I was like, so how'd you like get into volunteering here? He's like, well, I recently learned that crows are really intelligent and can formulate. And I was like, I don't know what that has to do with volunteering here, but never stop talk. But it was so funny.
That is, you're like, this seems like an unrelated tangent, but okay.
Basically, it was like he went to a park to feed the crows to try to befriend them. And he saw an unhoused person and he's like, why am I feeding the crows when I could be helping actual human beings? I'm like, you can do both, but good for you for like seeing a situation and doing something constructive. Something. Yeah, it was very sweet.
That's when you also sneak in. Yeah, feeding them isn't going to work. Give them something shiny.
Give them something. Well, they do love food.
They like both.
Yes. So we're actually going to learn about what they love. So this is an article from Audubon. Birds in the News, words by Dan Nosowitz. It literally says words by.
Okay.
In return for food, Gabby Mann gets some bizarre gifts from her feathered allies.
Yeah, like that's why crows and ravens are neat. Once you do befriend them, they're like, I like you. Here's a gift. Like you bring me things. Let me bring you things.
So I'm going to read the article because it is everything. What if we could be friends with wild birds? Seattle native Gabby Mann seems to have achieved that goal with one of the smartest species on the planet, the American crow. Never mind that she's only 8 years old.
Oh, damn. I thought, for some reason, I thought she was going to be like a 13 or 14, like a teenager.
Nope. She's a little baby goth, and I love her. This imaginative kid has a unique relationship with her neighborhood corvids.
Also, told. I hope she's like not goth at all. I hope she just like runs around in princess outfits and Emily's like the little goth and she's just not at all. She just really likes birds.
I actually do kind of hope that she's basically fulfilling her Disney princess mega fantasy.
Except she's like, I don't need robins. I have fucking crows.
Yeah. It's like if Maleficent wasn't as dark. This imaginative kid has a unique relationship with her neighborhood corvids, as told in a story by the BBC News magazine.
I like how many people have covered this story about
it all started 2 years ago. She's six. Coolest six-year-old on the planet. When Gabby began feeding local flocks of crows. At first, it was haphazard. A dropped chicken nugget here, a crumb from a sandwich there. Which I'm like, it's a little fucked up that they're eating chicken nuggets, but crows do, they're like,
they'll eat anything.
Fuck you, I mean, fuck everything. Yeah. They would probably
I'm pretty sure they're omnivores.
Yes. But the crows took notice, and soon enough, Gabby's hospitality went from being accidental to intentional.
I was gonna say, yeah, like the dropped crumb, I'm like, that doesn't sound intentional. Like, that doesn't sound like you're feeding the birds. That sounds like you're eating a sandwich outside.
Yeah. Well, she's six. So, yeah.
She was Zana.
Oh, I was going to say.
She's like a little ghost running past the window. And I was like, what?
I love Atari was the Grim Reaper. Zana is a ghost. We see her out of the corner of her eyes and we're like, ghost.
Yeah.
So, these days, Gabby's crows perch nearby whenever she's outside, hoping for a feast or even just a morsel. But the spirit of giving inhabits both the girl and the beast. The man who wrote this.
Very eloquent. I think he has a creative writing degree.
He had so much fun with this, and he did it so well.
He has a creative writing degree, but he's like, but I need to make money.
Soon enough, the crows were showering Gabby with all sorts of loot.
Yep.
Every day, Gabby leaves out food, mostly peanuts, which are a big hit, in the backyard for her groupies.
I want groupies.
I know.
I want crow groupies specifically.
In return, they leave her gifts, shiny baubles like polished sea glass and otter trinkets like a rusty screw or tube of chapstick.
It's literally like anything shiny.
Also, the chapstick, you always need chapstick. You're always wearing the coat that doesn't have it in the pocket.
I would not trust chapstick that just appeared, though.
Okay.
I'd be like, this probably was stolen from someone, and while I appreciate it, I don't need mouth herpes.
Here's the thing. You cut off the top.
That's true.
And then it's like a new chapstick.
That's true.
Yeah. Don't insult the crows by not accepting their chapstick. They're giving you a message, Kelly. Your lips are dry.
Ouch.
Also, my lips are very dry. In what could have been a coincidence or a lovely curiosity, the crows promptly returned a lens cap that Gabby had lost while taking some photographs of a bird, naturally, in an alleyway. And so the plot thickened.
What is this? Like a weird... Is this going to turn into like a murder mystery? Girl
like...
and birds solve murder mystery?
The plot thickens. Oh my God. And it's called... A Murder for Crows. Kelly, TM, TM, TM. Yeah.
Dips, copyright. Dips. Copyright whining about her street.
Nancy Drew with crows.
March 15th, 2024. Jesus, I was going to say 1994.
Crows and other members of the Corvid family, which also include jays, magpies, and ravens, are renowned for their intelligence.
They're
bitchy. They're known to be prodigious tool users and are more adept with tools than all other animals short of the great apes. Even more than the mid and lesser apes. the one star apes.
Yeah, the one star apes, yeah.
Humanity. Even their social behavior mirrors ours in some ways. They've been observed performing funeral rites for their deceased members of their murder. It's the name for a group of crows. Not sinister at all! Gift giving isn't uncommon among crows. John Marsloff, a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington who studies the relationship between crows and people, said in an interview with the BBC, "I can't say they always will give presents, but I have seen an awful lot of things crows have brought people."
Yeah.
Dead birds are one grisly example.
Yeah, they're kind of like cats in that respect. Look what I did.
This is for you. Eat this, please. Sometimes those gifts aren't entirely welcome. Gabby's mother once had to throw out a rotting crab claw that the crows had so lovingly bestowed upon her daughter. But Gabby doesn't seem to be perturbed by the oddities she receives. She keeps all her gifts carefully labeled and stored, treasuring them like precious jewels. Quote, "You may take a few close looks," she said to the BBC reporter, "but don't touch." Gabby is precious and we need to protect her at all costs. Also, Dan Nozowitz, king.
Keep writing.
Friend, write to us. Because, like, this is how I want to write the notes for our story.
Tell our story and then tell us how to write how you write.
Yes. So, me looking up a woman associated with crows or who studied crows.
Led to an 8-year-old that befriends crows.
Led to this little bad bitch. Which then also led me to the woman I'm actually whining about today.
Oh, damn. I thought you were done.
No. That was my say their name.
The long say their name, but it's fine.
It's to make up for all those other times we had no say their name. Now we're caught up. So today I'm whining about Frances Hammerstrom.
Oh.
And I'm just going to say this.
Very strong name.
This woman has all of the energy that little Gabby Man does.
Yeah.
This woman is.
This is what Gabby will one day manifest into being.
Frances is a fucking maverick. So Frances Flint, great last name, was born on December 16th, 1907 to wealthy parents in Boston, Massachusetts. Because even in 1907, you had to have a lot of money in income or student loans to live in Boston. Her family status afforded Frances a good education at the exclusive Milton Academy, which touts high-profiled alumni including two Kennedys, poet and playwright T.S. Eliot, and Betsy Beers, executive producer of Grey's Anatomy. I included that for you. I thought you would enjoy it.
I did. I appreciate that.
Yeah. But Frances's ambitions didn't lie in politics, poetry, or dramatic television. Rather, Frances was fascinated by the natural world. As a child, she learned to hunt, planted and tended to gardens, and kept wild pets. She def had a murder of crows that she befriended and taught to harass her bullies.
Heck yeah, that's what I would do.
So she was basically the kid who would bring a squirrel or possum home and be like, "Can I keep it?" And then when her parents kept saying no, she's like, "I'ma keep it anyway and keep it on the DL."
Exactly.
She's like, "I'm gonna figure out how to do this." So her parents were nonplussed about Frances's outdoorsy nature, complaining that it was unladylike behavior. As Frances would later write, quote, "Grown-ups forbade wild pets and tried to squelch my companionship with creepy, crawly creatures." But nothing was going to get in the way of Frances and her flower child fantasies, and she went full poison ivy, literally. She hid her wilderness gear in the woods and planted poison ivy along the path leading to it so that no one could follow and discover it. Frances, who was naturally immune to poison ivy, had no problem traversing the poisonous path.
Nice.
She's chemical warfare, or biological warfare. this fucking child to keep her wilderness love alive is actually installing like defense countermeasures in the form of poison ivy. As an adult, Frances attended and proudly flunked out of Smith College, one of the Seven Sisters schools, due to her interest in, quote, birds and boys. First, Frances pursued her interest in boys. She met Frederick Hammerstrom at a dance, and the two married in secret in 1931.
She's keeping all these secrets.
Frances gives no fucks. She does what she wants, when she wants, how she wants. And I fucking love her. The two were truly birds of a feather. Frances described Frederick as a naturalist at heart in her memoir, and they would stay married for 59 years until Frederick's death of pancreatic cancer. So now that her interest in boys was satisfied, next came the birds. Nowadays, there are plenty of career paths for someone interested in natural sciences, but at this time, wildlife management and research was still in its infancy. One early naturalist, Aldo Leopold, was working to establish the field. And that name struck me because my fella, we went to his cousin's wedding in Madison, Wisconsin, and it was held at the Aldo Leopold Nature Center because they're both vets.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so I actually learned a bunch more about him and why he's That's such a big cool. fucking deal.
Also, it sounds like his name got reversed. Because to me, Leopold is a first name, and Aldo sounds more like a last name. And I'm like, huh, okay.
Oh, yeah, Aldo Leopold.
Love it.
So Leopold was a professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
I wouldn't have guessed.
Deeply shaken to my cheesy core. An advocate for environmental ethics and wilderness conservation. And there is a lovely nature center in Madison named after him where I attended a wedding and it was beautiful and I got bit to shit by mosquitoes and I still had a good time.
Yeah, that sounds about, like everything about that sentence sounds defining the Midwest right there.
No, it was a really beautiful ceremony. It was outside like with the prairie. Yeah. They've got like a preserved prairie area and like paths you can walk. And like we took a walk through the paths layer. It was awesome.
Awesome.
It was so cool. So Frances had the opportunity to meet Leopold and was inspired to give college another try, earning her bachelor's degree in biology from Iowa State College in 1935. Upon graduating, the couple moved to Wisconsin, where Frances attended the University of Wisconsin in Madison, studying under Aldo Leopold as his only female grad student.
Well, it's a Wisconsinite, Emily.
She is.
I
can't believe you. Well, okay, here's the thing.
Okay.
Oh my God, what was the other? Mildred Fish Harnack?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to say it is not their fault. Wisconsin has failed them by not living up to their example.
That's true. They weren't born and bred there. It's fine.
We also met in Wisconsin, so I feel like we have. Again, Wisconsin
this is why
doesn't live
we
up
shit on Wisconsin,
to
guys.
Our example, okay? Wisconsin, do better. Live up to our example, which is not very high. We have not set the bar high.
No. We're working on it.
We're
year after year, we move it like a millimeter. It's fine.
Yeah, and Wisconsin's still not there.
Nope.
So she attended the UW-Madison, studying under, and her husband, Frederick, also worked at a wildlife refuge. So, like, this is her story, but her and Frederick did everything together. They were, like, a true naturalist power couple. He does not have a wiki page, though, which makes me a little sad, because he sounds like he was a really cool guy, but she definitely, this is one of those rare cases where the wife has outshone the husband as far as notoriety and recognition, but she's still pretty, I don't think she's very well known regardless.
I'm making weird noises because I feel like our uteruses are glowing because my story also features a natural science-based power couple.
My uterus feels warm with anticipation.
in the best way.
So Frances and Frederick bought, and this is the craziest fucking shit. I just want to like have coffee with these. Mm-hmm. I want to drink with these two because they are wild. So Frances and Frederick bought and lived in an 1850s era farmhouse that had been converted from a stagecoach stop.
That sounds awesome.
In Plainfield, Wisconsin.
It's like you hear people that they like will convert like old apple barns and stuff like that into houses. And I'm like, can I just come see your house?
Just wait. The historic home lacked the luxuries of heat or running water.
Nice.
And what it lacked in basic utilities, it never had that. Like, they were, yeah, like, we're going to fix it. And they never finished it. Like, famous last words.
I know. Like, who needs indoor plumbing?
We all have those projects that we're never going to fully finish. It's not our whole house, though.
No.
So what it lacked in basic utilities, it made up for in having an incomplete ballroom on the second floor.
Okay.
Which the couple would use to source specimens from their research.
Aww.
The couple would also have two children who were raised there who were avid naturalists.
Yeah, I mean, they had to go poop in the woods, so it makes sense.
Yeah, no, they're like, what do you mean water just comes out of the sink? What sorcery is this?
You're like, no, you have to go spend like 20 minutes at a pump pumping as much water as you need for your bath. That's just how it works.
So Frances would later, when talking with a friend, describe the home and the situation as, we had all the luxuries, such as an ornithological library, but none of the necessities.
That sounds like something I would do. Just be like, I have all these really nice bottles of wine, but we don't have any wine glasses or anything else.
That also sounds like me, exactly. Where it's like, oh yeah, no, my sink is full of dishes, so we're going to have to drink straight from the bottles.
Exactly.
But I do have running water and power.
Yeah, me too, obviously.
In 1940, Frances earned her master's in wildlife management, making her the first woman to do so.
Nice.
Go, Frances.
So while earning her master's, Frances became particularly concerned with one of Wisconsin's most majestic birds.
I mean, we know where this is going. For a second, I was like, who are we talking about? And then I was like, wait a minute, this is a story about crows.
Nope.
Oh.
No,
the heron.
Getting into women ornithologists,
you started at crows and
I
went
started
elsewhere.
With crows and I expanded my search because right. There was no one coming
what
up.
What is Wisconsin's most majestic bird?
The greater prairie chicken. And I need you. Yep. Kelly's like, grabbing
on,
her
I need
phone.
To Google this.
She fucking knows. And that's my next line. I want everyone to take a moment, if it is safe to do so, to Google the greater prairie chicken. So, a member of the grouse family.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I was like, it looks like a grouse.
The greater prairie chicken, also called a boomer, was once abundant, pitter-pattering across North American prairies with all of the undeserved confidence you would imagine from a tiny bird that looks like it's smuggling clementines in its jowls.
Yeah, it's kind of fantastic.
These fucking absurd birds don't migrate and are highly territorial. During mating season, males will gather on what they call a booming ground in a large group called a lek to put on a display to attract females.
Also, they have like ears similar to that of like a great horned owl or like a rabbit almost.
Yeah. So when they're doing their feathers.
Yeah.
But when they're doing their mating dance, yeah, they puff up their jowls and they put the feathers up. So it almost looks like they have little rabbit ears or horns.
Yeah. So that's why I said like it's similar to like the great horned owl.
So this is where those sweet clementine jowls come in handy. Males will inflate these orange sacks, snap their tails, raise their neck feathers to look like horns, and dance around. A male may carry on this display for 2 months in attempt to mate or remate with females.
So I need to tell Justin to get dancing. Like, come on, you have not done enough dancing to win me yet.
You need to like see the video of these little bastards because they are so insane. They're so, just the funny. I almost want to get a tattoo of one because they're so fucking weird and funny, and I love them.
Yeah.
Oh my God. But yeah, they'll like what they do is the males will just dance and dance and dance and fuck any female that. You know, will take them, you know, because they got to spread that seed. They got to spread those sweet orange seeds. So this practice kept the prairie chicken population going millions strong until European settlers nearly wiped them out due to habitat loss and overhunting. The loss of population also reduced genetic diversity among surviving populations, meaning there was a lot of prairie chicken inbreeding, further weakening future generations. Even in chickens, don't marry your cousin. By the 1930s, these sweet, spunky, inbred boomers were nearly extinct.
I'm sorry, I'm watching a video of their dancing. And it's like feet stomping and then oranges and then feet stomping and then oranges. And I'm like, oh, this is adorable and I love it.
It is the best thing in the world. I love these. I love these little bastards. Inbred boomer bastards.
Majestic version. Or what?
Wisconsin's most majestic bird. 100%. So, lucky for them, they had a champion in Francis and Frederick Hammerstrom. Francis and Frederick focused their research on the Buena Vista and Leola marshes in Wisconsin, studying the prairie chickens' habitats. And based on their research, they developed a habitat management plan to preserve the existing habitats and worked on further preservation efforts. While preserving existing habitats was necessary, there was also the issue of the lack of available habitats. You know, it's like, okay, we got to keep what we have, but we don't have a lot. So to address this, Francis and Frederick founded the Society of, the pronunciation. Here's some linguistic butchery in Latin. The Society of Tympanicus Cupido Pinatus, or it's Latin for prairie grouse, to purchase over 2,000 acres of land, which they made into new prairie chicken habitats. But charity starts at home, and the couple who owned that like little farm with no running water or electricity, but it had the ballroom upstairs with all their specimens. It was also surrounded by grasslands. So they used the surrounding grasslands to shelter over 2,000 of these orange bulb boomers.
Heck yeah.
It's just like, I'm just imagining they get them like, we have electricity, but look at all this majestic shit. It's just a bunch of males going like, it's just like with the little jowls and their little feather.
Well, I mean, the reason apparently it's called they're called boomers is because that's the noise. The video I watched, we're recording, so I didn't watch it with audio. But apparently, the video I watched also just didn't have audio.
Yep.
But it said that in captions that like apparently, when they inflate the things that look like clementines, that's what it makes like a booming noise.
I love it so much.
It's like, is that thunder? No, it's just the chickens.
Oh, it's just the prairie chickens.
Don't worry about it.
Don't you worry about
those
it,
little
hon.
Little boomers.
You know what? It's just in this 2 months, starting in April. Don't worry about 2 months. Yeah, don't. You
it's
get
fine.
Used to it.
It's fine.
It's like rainfall. You fall asleep to it. It's gorgeous. And then we eat them. No, they're endangered.
Wrong kind of chicken.
So like nature, Frances was all about diversifying. Along with her efforts to save the prairie chicken, she also conducted studies on the northern harrier, which is a type of hawk. And I looked it up. It looks like any hawk that we would see like when we're driving on any of the Midwest country roads. And and everyone goes, oh my God, a hawk, even though it's gone and no one else in the car can see it. But you have to let everyone know you saw it.
One. Yep.
I do that all the time.
Or was that an eagle? No, there wasn't white.
Yeah,
that's the conversation.
I've actually gotten really good at spotting, but like since living here, I've gotten really good at spotting bald eagles.
Yeah, because we actually have a bunch.
Yeah,
like in the local area,
in Rochester,
yes.
I see them from work sometimes. Yeah. We have a meeting because there's a river.
Yeah, you're
and
like
then a
right
nest.
There.
Yeah, so very cool. So, Frances worked for the Department of Natural Resources for 23 years, fighting to protect natural habitats and wildlife. Throughout her career, she authored classics such as Effective Voles on Mating Systems in a central Wisconsin Population of Harriers, Strictly for the Chickens, and Is She Coming Too? Memoirs of a Lady Hunter.
Oh.
It's got the best titles.
Is She Coming Too?
I fucking love this woman.
Yes.
Frances appreciated wild animals in all their forms, writing a wild game cookbook called Wild Foods Cookbook from the Fields and Forests of the Great Lakes States. And that was actually illustrated by her daughter, which I think is so cute. In this book, she bragged that her secret to the perfect pie crust was bear lard.
I was going to say, it's going to be lard. I didn't assume it would be bear lard. That's very specific.
I don't even know where to get bear lard, but Frances didn't have to worry about that because
a bear, Emily.
In gratitude, readers would send her bear lard from their own bear kills. She was getting bear lard.
That's how you do it.
Like, We get nice emails and comments on social media.
I mean,
she's getting tubs of Canadian money. We did
once.
No, we've gotten some lovely things, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Getting tubs a can of Bear-a-lard is an entirely
regularly.
Different. She's on a whole other planet of fandom. So to ensure the future of wildlife conservation was prominent, Frances trained hundreds of research assistants that she affectionately referred to as gaboons. After Frederick's death, and this was like, I think in 1990, Frances, a spry woman in her mid-80s, decided to travel the world visiting Saudi Arabia and the continents of Africa and South America. While on an expedition in Peru, the 86-year-old maverick broke her fucking hip and had to be evacuated by helicopter, only to return the next year to study hunting practices of a tribe on the Amazon River.
Fuck yeah.
She's like, my hip's
better.
She's like,
fuck you, Peru. I'm coming back.
Peru, I'm not done with you. I'm not done with you, Peru. And that's like what, oh my God, I'm not done with you, Peru. Number two, Electric Boogaloo.
How many times can Emily fit Electric Boogaloo into titles on our episodes? This would be number three.
Electric Boogaloo, I don't know. So on August 29th, 1998, at 90 years old. So she's doing all this three years before she dies. This woman is fucking insane. Frances Hammerstrom passed away in Port Edwards, Wisconsin, presumably because she made the conscious decision to greet death like an old friend rather than any force of nature being able to take her down.
I like to think she's like a bear with the bears.
She did go. I hope that's what they call heaven. It's like, mom's gone to live with the great bears in the sky. She's gone to a beautiful bear farm with the prairie chickens where she's got lots of room to run around. She falls asleep to the booming. It's always booming season and with the great bear in the sky.
I like that we started out with Minnesotan, Wisconsin accents, and then we went like weird,
rural,
stereotypical southern. Yeah.
I'm just going to say that captures the essence of rural Wisconsin.
It's true.
So legacy.
It's the spirit of rural
Wisconsin. It's the spirit of rural Wisconsin.
Rural South.
Rural. So while Frances.
Let's not go down that road again.
So while Frances.
It's for our patrons only.
While Frances Hammerstrom may not be a household name for us, she is honored in the field of ornithology and as a pioneer of wildlife conservation, especially in Wisconsin. She received an honorary doctorate from Carroll University in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Frances and how many like fun Wisconsin towns can I fit in here? Not enough. I did like Madison, Port Edwards. Waukesha was really the fun one.
Yeah.
Frances and Frederick were inducted into the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame.
Ooh.
Frances received the Notable Wisconsin Author Awards from the Wisconsin Library Association.
How many times can you say Wisconsin?
Wisconsin. So many times. I mean, honestly, with hits like Strictly for the Chickens and Is She Coming To? Memoirs of a Lady Hunter.
Like, Is She Coming To? As someone who used to sell guns in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
Just some people's reactions to like females knowing anything about guns is shocking to me. So I love that she wrote a book that is literally titled Is She Coming To? Because that's probably what she got asked all the time.
Constantly. Well, and then even just in her field, because she did field work, like she was out there.
Yeah.
You know, also, I find it interesting, like Wisconsin is the Midwest, the United States is a very like
hunting
gun heavy place. But, like, in a place where they want teachers to have guns, they were shocked that a woman would know about guns. It's like, you know, teaching is a female-dominated field, right? So you shouldn't be surprised when women know how to use guns if you want them to be armed with them in classrooms around children. Also, this is absurd. Stop. Anyway, that's not what this is about. The Prairie Grouse Technical Council and Raptor Research Foundation offer lifetime achievement awards in the names of Frances and Frederick. Which also, like, cutest couple name, Frances and Frederick. And of course, perhaps Frances's greatest living legacy, those sweet inbred boomers, the prairie chickens. Today, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources manages over 30,000 acres of habitat for these goofy little fuckers. Birders from all over the world descend on Wisconsin in April to attend the Central Wisconsin Prairie Chicken Festival.
You know we need to go this
year, I'm booking my tickets.
Yeah. What did you say it was called? Central Wisconsin Prairie Chicken Festival?
Yes.
Okay. Keep talking.
And no, that is just the story of Frances Hammerstrom, protector of the prairie chickens. A hero for all weird-jowled birds. But seriously, there are photos of her, like, with hawks on her arms and hanging out with turkeys. And, like, she was all for, like, wildlife in general, but she really focused on Boyds. Yeah, and ornithology.
Boyds.
I can't. I need to work on my
The Wada Boyds.
The Wada Boyds.
It starts at 4:30 in the morning.
That's too early.
On April 13th.
Do you think we can get them to reschedule it?
Can you guys just back it up like 2 hours?
Okay, is it like a hard 4:30 or like can we roll in around 10?
It's 4:30 a.m. to noon, it looks
like. Are you fucking kidding me?
Well, so from 4:30 to 7:30 a.m., you can reserve a seat in the observation blinds to watch the displays of greater prairie chickens on the grasslands. You also get breakfast.
We fucking better.
At 8 a.m., there is a public, like, that's when, like, the public comes. People who didn't reserve seats to watch the prairie chickens can come and eat breakfast.
Oh, my God.
And then 9 to 10 is, like, presentations, an appearance of Booming Bob. Don't know who that is.
God.
I assume it's a person dressed as a chicken.
Damn it.
And then from 10:15 to 11:15... you can walk with Booming Bob and other birding experts to learn about the species. And then that's it.
Thank you, Francis, for bestowing this boomer of a gift on us.
It's in Millidor, Wisconsin.
Millidor. I don't even know where that is. I don't either.
Let me zoom out. It's literally like almost in the center of Wisconsin.
Of course it fucking is.
It's slightly west of Stevens Point.
Oh, there's a university there. I wonder if that's like one of their field trips. Maybe it's like a thing when you go to UW Stevens Point to like, oh yeah, we're all gonna like stay up late and then go watch the boomers. Yeah, we're gonna be hungover, but we're all 22, so it doesn't matter.
It's basically like directly east of like Red Wing, but halfway into Wisconsin.
Okay. We could, you know.
It's in like 4 weeks. Actually, it's like exactly 4 weeks.
We can make that work.
It's on a Saturday. We'll just drive out there Sunday.
Wait, what?
I was kidding.
I was like a week ahead?
No, we'll drive out there Friday.
The day
after.
Is what I meant.
Okay. Like, but I said Sunday, and that makes no sense.
That's okay, because time is all made up.
Yeah, it is.
It's all Jeremy Baramy. Don't worry about it.
Jeremy Baramy.
It's from The Good Place.
I know.
Okay. I love it. Jeremy Baramy. That's what I want to name my next cat. Jeremy Baramy. Oh my God. No, that's going to be my funeral home name.
Oh, there's a bug up there.
No, I just thought of the best funeral home name.
Jeremy Baramy. Could also be a porn name.
Oh my God. Jeremy Baramy. Coming to the stage, Jeremy Baramy.
There we go.
All right, done. My porn career is set. I have already won 5 awards and starred in 10,000 films.
Look her up.
look me up on my IMDb under Jeremy, bury your cock in me.
It just gets longer every time you say it.
It gets longer.
Didn't even intentionally do that.
That was fucking good. Also, yes, it just gets longer and
every
more explicit. Longer and harder to remember.
No, you just longer and harder.
Longer and harder.
It's longer and harder every time you say it.
What a great ad break that we hopefully had, because I figured out how to insert them on our new hosting now.
Yay! Otherwise, you just have to hard insert them.
Yeah. And then it's difficult to change them out and insert them other places.
I mean, I don't think we've ever had any other sponsor, but still.
Well, we've had like other podcast ads and stuff.
That's true.
And it would have been cool to put those in all of our episodes.
But no. Not yet.
Technology
Hopefully
is hard.
One day.
Technology is hard for us aged, ragged 30-somethings. I mean, by the time this comes out, Kelly is going to be,
I'll be so
firmly in her early 30s. Not like tiptoeing.
Firmly.
She's knee deep in her early 30s.
Knee deep.
Join me, Kelly. We're gonna grow old together.
It's been like less than a month. Calm down.
Yeah, but I've had two hip surgeries and back palms since I was 13, yeah. So I'm an honorary member of AARP.
Yeah. It was funny. I was talking to someone today that I think is younger than me, and they were like, I don't know why my knee hurts. And I like looked at them and I'm like, it's the weather. And they're like, what? And I'm like, I'm not joking. Like, where, when the barometric pressure changes, if you have problems with your joints, because yep. I do, I have knee problems. And I'm like, if you have problems with your joints, it's going to hurt. And they like looked at me and they're like, oh shit. I'm like, yeah.
Can I just, welcome. Like, ooh, more young flesh for exactly. us to consume. Welcome to aging.
Welcome to barometric pressure, bitches.
Welcome to your body not being under your control, but rather under the control of literally anything else.
I've had knee problems since I was like 16, so I wasn't even like old when this barometric pressure bullshit started.
Yeah.
I just know now that I'm like, yeah, it's Minnesota's being stupid and it's going to get cold again soon. So my knees fucking hurt.
When I have guests at the hotel who are saying like, oh, you know, I'm getting surgery tomorrow or something like that. I was like, I'm always like, you're in great hands. I have them do both my hips. I would have had them do my third if I had one, you know, and just kind of, and they're like,
oh, that's cheesy.
You've had a hip surgery, but it works.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Because but, you're like, I'm young and you can't even tell, bitches.
Boom. I'm actually 80. The secret is generic lotion. But no, I'm like,
Avena.
They're always like, wait,
moisturizer.
You Cetaphil. But they're always like, wait, you've had hip surgeries? I'm like, I know. I look so young for 80. Or it's like, I'm in my 30s, but my hips are in their 80s.
Madonna, like Vogue.
I should just start like bitching about New Coke.
Yeah.
And then they're going to be like, oh yeah, you're old bitch.
Damn kids on my lawn.
Hands across America. The president's a peanut farmer.
Oh my God.
So Kelly, who the fuck are you whining about? So I can stop sounding old.
So I'm whining about Katya Kraft. Who, it's going to end up being about a power couple, but it's mainly about Katya Kraft.
Also, like my story, our uteruses are
exactly.
glowing.
That's why I told you, like earlier. Oh my God. I was like, it's your uterus glowing.
I feel the warmth in my Good. Innards. My bits.
My bits.
My bits. My bits are on fire.
So Katya was born Catherine Josephine Conrad in the Rhine Valley of Northeast France.
That's my next cat's name.
France?
No. Katharina Josephine Conrad.
It's Catherine. Catherine.
Catherine. Catherine Josephine Conrad.
She goes by Katya.
Katya.
I mean, very like Russian sounding. I remember when I came across her being like, oh, this must be a Russian person. And I was like, nope, it's French.
First of all, naming a cat Katya.
Katya would be
perfect.
Fantastic.
Katya Josephine Conrad. Can you imagine? Like Arthur acts up and I yell at him. I'm like, shit, cat. Katya Josephine Conrad, you little fucker.
How dare you?
You bitch.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah. Honestly, that would be a better name for a dog because you get the opportunity to yell in public more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you imagine your dog's barking? Katya Josephine Conrad Jr., you get your fucking ass over here like, right now.
You threw a junior in there.
Esquire.
Esquire the third. Wait, she can't be a junior and a third. Yes, she can.
She can be all of the things. But, don't tell her what she can and can't be, you patriarchal swine.
So yes, she was born in the Rhine Valley of France, Northeast France, April 17th, 1942, during the height of World War II.
Oh, that's a...
Not the greatest time to be born.
What a tough time to be pregnant and give birth to.
Right,
let's pour
I'm
some
like,
out
I,
for her
I
mom.
I want to kind of know some about Katya's mom, because that sounds terrible.
Like, I'm just imagining her mom is in a basement giving birth while the air raid sirens are going off, or like
well,
some
like
fuckers are goose-stepping.
France, like, all of that was conquered by Germany all the way to Paris.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know a lot about her early life, as is typical with a lot of these women, but growing up, she fell in love with volcanoes. She saw pictures of them and instantly was like, this is what I want to study, and redirected her education into geology. She would go on to graduate from the University of Strasbourg with degrees in physics and chemistry.
Oh my fucking God. Okay, first of all, I love her both covering STEM ladies. Second of all, every kid goes through their volcano phase. It may
this,
be
this person never grew up.
It may be paired with a dinosaur, hurricane, tornado, / any kind of disaster phase, as a la moi. I love that she turned it into a career.
Oh yeah. So while she was at the University of Strasbourg, she met her husband, Maurice Kraft. They were both students studying slightly different things, but both very interested in volcanoes.
Okay, so my dog's name is Katia Josephine Conrad. My cat's name is Maurice.
Yes.
That feels appropriate. Like Maurice. Yeah.
So this is from one of the sources I found. It says they were quite different both in appearance and character. Maurice was Herculean in his description. Very determined in pursuit of his goals with winning. He had a very loud and resolute voice and was always ready to like be the center of attention. He always had a laugh ready, was very just like very personable, like to be the center of attention, but also very like genuine and personable. Katia, on the other hand, was considered dainty and graceful. She was often smiling, but much more silent.
Okay, so he was the dog person in the relationship, oh, yeah, and she was the cat person, yep. Even though she would
Their
have
names
the dog
are
name.
Reversed, yeah.
I also, growing up, I definitely identified more with cats, but the older I've gotten, the more I realize I am the dog person in most relationships. So you were talking about Marisa, I'm like, stop calling me out like this. I don't appreciate these personal attacks.
Yeah. So while she was considered like dainty and graceful and silent, she was also considered like equally as determined and alert. She was very strong. Like she had a very modest but strong self-confidence. Like she knew who she was. She knew what she wanted. She just wasn't like loud and boisterous about it.
She didn't need to overcompensate by being loud and obnoxious like other people who will go unnamed.
Yeah. So a lot of the story is going to end up being about both of them because a lot of people described them as that they were one like entity. You really couldn't get one without the other. Apparently even like Maurice once in an interview said, quote, "I am the whale and Katia is the pilot fish." Meaning like they're always together. Like they're separate but together.
But also they're very different, exactly. But they work together so beautifully.
Yep.
Like, and they're symbiotic. Oh, right. My God.
And they would both usually work around the clock, but would also still remain, like, charming and extroverted, hosting parties and friends. And, yeah, like I said, you really didn't get one without the other. So they met, they immediately became this couple, and they would eventually marry in 1970. And they would honeymoon on the island of Stromboli, which... If people don't know, it's off the north coast of Sicily, and it contains Mount Stromboli, which is one of four active volcanoes in Italy.
They're such nerds. Oh, yeah.
They like one of the things that drew them together was their they both had a passion for volcanoes in specifics, and there's a lot of articles because there's a film that came out that I'll talk about at the very very end that I really want to watch because I haven't watched it yet and we should watch it together. That basically people were like, it was a love triangle between Maurice, Katia, and volcanoes.
Okay. It was Emily something or other who helped build the Brooklyn Bridge where her and her husband went on a honeymoon, but it was really to study bridges. Yeah. And I was just like, fucking nerds. This is the same energy.
No, that's exactly it. So they went to the island of Sicily where Mount Stromboli was located, and they would continuously photographing its near continuous eruption during their honeymoon.
Wait, it was erupting while they were there?
Yeah. That's their thing. They're volcanologists.
Okay, I understand that, but there's also a sense of not dying.
Yep.
How? Okay. Yep. You know what? They know better than me. I'm not going to idiot explain these two volcanologists. I was trying to make volcanologists and nerd a thing.
Yeah, that's kind of close. So yeah, afterward they would recognize that the public was actually like really interested in the documentation of volcanic eruptions. They would make a career out of taking pictures and filming it. But also, like, they would do a lot of other things with it, too. They would inform people that lived around volcanoes of, like, how do you tell when it's about to erupt so that you can get away safely? And, like, they would do all of this stuff.
I figured it out. Volcano nerds.
There you go. So Katya, specifically, started her career with Maurice, but, like, she would start her career by taking gas samples at volcanoes that were erupting, documenting eruptions in person. She would often be taking photos. She would write a lot of books on her findings to help fund these trips that, like, she was taking to witness volcanoes erupting, because obviously it's all over the world. And her books would pioneer, like, this new area of volcanic coverage. Because, yeah, like, most people are like, I'm not going to get that close to a volcano. Whereas Katya would literally, like, walk up to the edge of the molten erupting volcano to get these notes and samples.
Again, how life? How do you not get unalived?
Yep.
It blows my mind.
Yeah.
But also, you know, in the 70s, like, obviously we have photographs and, like, maybe some terrible video of volcanic eruptions before this, but this is, like, everything's in color, the video quality is better, and also she's educated enough to know when this stuff is going to happen, or, like, when to be prepared so she can document it. So, like, yeah, what a spectacle that is now more widely available in a better form.
Even back then, because this is the 1990s, 1980s, somewhere in there, a lot of people still weren't photographing and video recording volcanoes up close. This is before drones. This is before a lot of the protective equipment was developed. So, like, even what they're doing is still cutting edge, even though, yeah, we're like, oh, colored things of volcanoes is very much a thing. It is. But in the 1980s and 1990s, it really wasn't. Like, they were right on the edge of, and they're some of the reasons we have the footage we have.
Well, Mount St. Helens, I think that's, for people of our generation, that's kind of the definitive eruption in North America that everyone talks about.
A lot of those photos were colorized after the fact.
Were they? I didn't know that.
It's the eruption I'm thinking of.
Well, so
even Katya and Maurice's, not a lot, but some of their photos were taken in black and white, and then they colorized them themselves.
But what I'm saying is there was someone actively studying it, and they kind of knew it was coming, but yeah, there's no video of it happening. There were a few stills, like, as it's happening, and I think actually
it's still mostly black and white.
Yeah, but
it is black and white.
But there was a volcanologist or a geologist who was studying it who did not survive because he was too close. But I think we have some photos from his research.
Interesting. I did not research into that.
I'm gonna have to look it up just for myself because of who I am. Yeah.
So it said 57 people died when Mount St. Helens erupted, including volcanologist David A. Johnston and photojournalist Reed Blackburn, who were both documenting the stuff.
So again, I just want, and I'm not trying to derail your story, but the fact that she's getting this close and this in depth with trying to document this stuff, this is not without a sense of personal risk.
Yeah. And I definitely do talk about that later. But yeah, so, like, they're up close footage, and I sent you a picture, Emily, and that is Katya walking away. That's Katya in the picture.
I'm sorry. Hold on.
So the picture I sent Emily is of Katya in, like, a metal suit.
I'm sorry.
As a volcano is essentially erupting 10 feet behind her, maybe.
Hold on. I'm really glad I didn't look at this sooner.
Yeah.
Because Kelly's like, I'm going to send you a picture. I'm like, okay, are you going to tell me when to look at it? Like, can I look at it now? What the actual, this is like the walking away from an explosion scene in a movie, except it's literal lava.
Yeah.
She's in one of those, like, metal protective suits or aluminum or whatever. And there's literally a wave of lava erupting behind her. And there's just, like, the volcanic rock.
And just in case people didn't know, eruptions can get up to 1200 degrees Fahrenheit.
At
the point of eruption.
Do not actually understand how she's alive.
Yeah.
I do not understand how that
she's not anymore, but at the time of the picture, yes.
I don't understand how that
how it works.
That lava didn't rain down on her and just burn her to shit.
Yeah.
This is insane. Who took the photo?
Maurice.
God damn it. These fucking people.
So yeah, like their close-up footage of volcanic eruptions and like how close they were willing to get has been attributed to enhancing geologists' understanding and knowledge of the topic. Katya is cited as a pioneer in the field of female volcanologists, but while Katya used to say, well, one, she encountered extremely phenomenal sexism. This is the late 1980s, early 1990s. Emily has been lost to the photo.
She's got like bell bottoms.
Yeah,
I
know.
The suit has bell bottoms. Also, sexism. I hope she just carried this photo around. She's like, oh, you don't think I'm woman enough? Fuck you. Recreate this photo and then come at me, bitch.
Well, that's exactly the thing is that if you look into Katya and Maurice, well, first of all, the Wikipedia entry for these two, they don't have their own. They only have one. It is Katya and Maurice Kraft, which I'm like, okay, at least it's both of them, but still I'm a little annoyed. But they're, like I said, there's a documentary, which again, I'll talk more about later. But yeah, because she was a woman, she saw her work important to be a volcanologist, not to be pigeonholed as a woman volcanologist. So there's a lot of, like, in the documentary, or the people that made the documentary talked about, like, they encountered a lot of footage illustrating just how bad this sexism was. But one in particular, apparently, they were interviewed on a French talk show where the host specifically says, "We have with us today world-famous volcanologist adventurer Maurice Kraft and his wife, Katya."
Okay, this reminds me. So Stephen King and... shit. Hold on. I'm making the same mistake.
Yeah.
But Mr. and Mrs. King.
Yeah.
Made a big donation to an organization, and that organization credited Stephen King and his wife. And Stephen King wrote, or no, I think she wrote a rebuttal.
Good.
And like, hold on, I'm going to look it up because here's the thing.
Tabitha Spruce?
Yes. And I'm going to look this up. You keep talking, but because I'm making the same mistake that publication did, but she's like, I was right. Like, it's my money too. Are you fucking kidding me?
Right. I think for me, like my main thing is I'm like, why couldn't they have just said world famous volcanologists, Maurice and Katya Kraft? Like, that would literally have fixed the problem. Anyways, but so one of the things I want to note is Katya actually saw more erupting volcanoes than Maurice did. And Maurice would actually often correct these journalists and be like, no, like, we're both volcanologists, and two, like, Katya is more experienced than I am.
Yeah.
In this specific clip, Maurice didn't correct them, and you could see like Katya visibly like kind of getting tense. This isn't in the film that was later made, but like that's where I got like the source from. But it really just showed how Katya wanted herself viewed. Like, she wanted to be shown as her own person, her own volcanologist. And unfortunately, like, not even because of sexism, but just because Katya was not even shyer, but she was the quieter person that preferred to not be behind the camera. Maurice is often the one caught on camera, except in photographs.
Yeah.
Katya's a lot of the one photographed, but in a lot of their videos, it's Maurice because he had that personality where
he was the entertainer.
He wanted to be in front of the camera.
Yeah.
Where she's like, nah, I'll stay back here and take the samples and
do
the writing.
Just as important. They're different roles that need to be done.
Exactly.
So really quick, just to amend my previous huge fuck up where I was making the same mistake that I was criticizing. So the Associated Press published an article that stated Stephen King and his wife donated $1.25 million to New England Historic Genealogical Society. And Stephen King tweeted, "My wife is rightly pissed by headlines like this. Stephen King and his wife donate $1.25 million to New England Historic Genealogy, whatever.
Yeah.
The gift was her original idea, and she has a name, in all caps, Tabitha King. Her response follows, Dear editors, married to a wife or husband, in recent media coverage of a gift that my husband, ironic usage, and I made to the New England Historical and Genealogical Society, we became Stephen King and his wife. Wife is a relationship or status. It is not an identity. You could have made other choices. You could have referred to me as of Stephen or his old lady or his ball and chain. I have sons. You could have referred to me as mother of novelists. I have a daughter, but wouldn't it just be silly to refer to me as mother of clergy? I'm 70. I thought I would give you permission if of Tabitha predeceases me to title my obituary Relic of Stephen King. In the meantime, you might consider the unconscious condescension in your style book and give women their names. Tabitha yeah. fucking King.
Fuck yeah.
But yeah, no, this idea like the male, the man, even if it's not about him, you know?
Well, yeah, like sometimes you'll see
gets
like
the top billing.
You'll see like I've seen like a like these days someone will do something and it'll be like blah, blah, blah. I can't think of a specific example, so I'm not, like, trying to be rude, but it's, like, this woman dating professional athlete, blah, blah, blah. So it's, like, she did something, but you have to refer to her by who yeah. she is dating or who she is married to. And it's, like, why can't it just be this woman did this?
Yeah, it's, like, wife of NFL player exactly. breaks Olympic record. Whoa, 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 I'm sorry. She's the Olympian, and we referring
have to associate
to her.
Him.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, like that definitely happened to her. And luckily, like Maurice was very much, yeah, all about like, no, like we are equal, if not she is better than I am.
And I don't think this has to be like a you go girl kind no. of thing. I think it's just being recognized as a professional in your field.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, her gender was the reason she was overshadowed. And it wasn't about
her husband did at all.
No. But I feel like to her, it wasn't necessarily about her gender. I think it was her being snubbed as a professional, as a person. And really, when people talk about sexism, it's you are snubbing, you are disrespecting, you are dehumanizing people based on something very, very superficial.
Yeah. So yeah, the crafts and Katya in particular would take measurements of different measurements of volcanoes, gas readings, and samples, often feet away from pyroclastic and lava flows of volcanoes. They would document how the eruptions affected the local ecosystem, as well as how new volcanoes were formed, in addition to effects of the acid rain and ash clouds that are often produced by volcanoes.
I love all of this, but I'm so stressed.
Right. Throughout the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, early 90s, the crafts documented various volcanoes and the volcanic eruptions that would follow. Maurice would often film while Katya would take the photos, or, you know, Katya would be in the photos that Maurice was taking. Particularly on January 23rd, 1973, Katya was called to southern Iceland to study an extinct volcano that had suddenly erupted after thousands of years
oh,
of inactivity.
Shit. How scary is that? Because, yeah. like, for a volcano to be dormant, that just means it will erupt, but it's sleeping right now. It's not yeah. going to erupt, like, right now. For a volcano to be classified as extinct, that means you don't
think like, it's never going to erupt ever
it's
again.
It's done.
Exactly.
We're never going to see this thing blow its top. Exactly. And then for it to do that, horrifying.
Right. So since volcanoes, particularly, yeah, extinct volcanoes that suddenly decide to not be extinct anymore, are unpredictable and dangerous, a lot of scientists at the time were afraid to even observe eruptions in person, whereas Katya was like, no, I'm going.
I'm not going to say they're not wrong.
I'm
not
no.
going to say they're wrong because, yeah. And I love that Katya is just such a little daredevil yeah. that she's like, no, I'm going to get up in there.
And if Maurice was busy away doing something else, she would still go on her own.
Yeah.
It didn't, like, she preferred him to be with her, and it didn't matter if she was or not. Like that photo showed, like she would get right up close to the edge of the volcano. And that's really what led her to fame and success as a volcanologist. And she would continue to push the boundaries. She would wear the suits, and there was a special helmet that literally looks like a rocket ship. You can, like, if you look at pictures of her, like a little rocket ship over her head to present that particular helmet, the second one, was to protect herself from falling rock. Like, it was solid metal.
That was my other thing. I'm like, okay, the lava's one thing, but there's a bunch of crap getting blown out here, too.
It depends on what type of flow there is. So there's, like, the lava flow, which is just the lava, and then there's the pyroclastic flow, which is, like, the ash and the gas and the gas and, like, the superheated stuff. There was also one time she would take a raft out into the center of a lake of acid to get readings just so she knew what was going on.
Okay, I have questions.
Yeah, so do I.
I have questions.
How did your boat survive?
I have questions that you cannot answer, and I am so frustrated.
So the crafts, both Katya and Maurice, would often be the first person, sometimes the only people at an active volcano site, and were respected, envied, and kind of on the outskirts of a lot of the volcanologists at the time. Katya would also, like, due to her photographs and the readings she would take, she ended up working with a lot of the local governments on safety procedures and helping develop volcano evacuation procedures for the towns surrounding some of these volcanoes.
Yeah.
Their footage of the effects of volcanic eruptions were particularly useful in gaining the cooperation of local authorities that were faced with volcanic threats. One notable example of this was at the onset of the activity of Mont Pinatubo in 1991.
Pinatubo.
Thank you. Their video of the effects of the eruption of Nevado del Ruiz in Colombia was shown to people living near the volcano in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And even the Philippine president, Cory Aquino, like, saw the video and was like, okay, no, like, we need, like, look at this destruction that this other volcano caused that was of similar size and of similar, like, readings. Like, we need to get our people the fuck out of here.
How is it that we as humans are both so easily whipped up, but when it's something that actually matters, we need to be, like, frightened into action?
But I do think about it. Like, if you've lived all your life in a volcano or on a volcano or near a volcano or in Tornado Alley, and you're like, oh, that siren goes off, but, like, 90% of the time it's nothing.
To be fair, that is actually how I respond to tornado sirens.
But 10% of the time, your house might get fucking torn
down. Dude, did I fucking tell you? Okay, so, like, growing up in Illinois, no stranger to tornadoes. My dad and I once we were going to go to the hardware store, and it started raining really bad, and we were about to get on the highway. I'm like, Dad, we shouldn't fucking get on the highway. He's like, no, it's fine. We get on the highway. It's a bad idea. We immediately get off the highway. We park in a parking lot and just try to wait out the rain because it's really bad. And then we decide to take, you know, the frontage roads home, because if you're not going 65 miles per hour, the rain is drivable.
Not as bad,
And then we're at this intersection. And of course, my mom is texting me the whole time, being like, get inside, get inside, get inside.
And you're like, Mom, it's fine.
And I'm like,
it's just some rain.
I'm, like, definitely halfway between my mom and my dad in that.
You're trying to have that middle ground, basically.
But anyway, we're at the stoplight and the tornado sirens go off. And I go, oh, shit. My dad's like, what? And I'm like, what do you mean what? The tornado sirens. He's like, there's not going to be a tornado. I'm like, Dad, one of the reasons that the Mayo Clinic is as prominent as it is because of a devastating tornado that ripped through this goddamn city in the 1800s. Don't you tell me there can't be a goddamn tornado. But my dad's just, he's rolling his eyes. And then we get to my house. And I'm like, you should come in and wait it out. He's like, no, I'm just going to head home. I'm like, Dad,
get in the fucking house.
Get in the fucking house. We're going to watch some Frasier. It's going to be over. We're just going to wait it out. And he was like, okay.
It's super funny.
But, like, I wasn't, like, super freaking out, but my dad was
freaking out at all.
He was actively not freaking out.
That reminds me.
I'm like, Dad!
I don't remember if it was last summer or the summer before, but it was stormy and kind of gross out, and me and Justin, I don't remember if we ran errands or if we literally only went to get Taco Bell. I can't remember.
Taco Bell is an errand.
Taco Bell breakfast. And we were in the drive-thru, and, like, as we pulled up to get our food, the tornado sirens go off. And I remember me and Justin made eye contact, and then me, Justin, and the guy in the drive-thru all made eye contact as a, like, what do we do in this situation? Because we're in our car.
Yeah.
And he's in the Taco Bell.
There's no basement in Taco Bell.
But we all look at each other kind of like, what do we do in this situation? You know, like clear confusion and like how concerned do we need to be? And yeah, it was a little green outside, but yeah, like the guy, like we all make eye contact, like, so and then the guy just goes and grabs our food and we drove home. And then we looked it up when we got home and we're like, okay, where is this tornado? It was like right on fucking top of us. Like it never manifested, but like people had seen like the start of a tornado literally like in our neighborhood. And we're like, all right, that could have been bad. Yeah. But at least we have Taco Bell. Like, but yeah, it was just like one
the
of those moments that like
champions.
That like all through, like me, Justin, the guy in Taco Bell, like all of us were kind of like, okay, how serious do we need to treat this? And what do we do?
There is also there are studies when you have a warning or when you do tests of alarms too often, people become desensitized to it.
That's why they only do it so often.
Them off prematurely. People don't care about, they don't pay attention anymore.
It has to be like things are touching down or someone has sighted it on the ground.
It's about, it's coming. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways.
But yeah, no, we also, that social proof, we look to each other. We look to other people regardless of their knowledge or survival instincts to figure out how to behave. You and Justin and the Taco Bell guy were all looking to each other for those social cues.
What do we do in this? And all of us were like, I don't know.
And that dude did the only thing that he could think to do, which was to get you your fucking food and get you out of there.
And I mean, I'll be honest, like, if me and Justin lived farther away from Taco Bell than we do, we live less than 5 minutes away from our Taco Bell, I probably would have been like, okay, maybe we should like pull into the Target and like go inside. But I was like, okay, we can make it home.
Yeah.
It'll be okay. Anyways. But yeah. So like due to all of this, like these videos and these evacuation plannings she's helping with, in 1969, Katya was awarded the prize of the Vocation Foundation for her. This was her first work. So this is actually predating a lot of this other work she did. Mm-hmm. But she won, the Vocation Foundation prize for her work. Like the fact that she was going to active volcanoes, mm-hmm. which is huge. Katya, like I said, would write a lot of books, and actually at one point they would make a documentary for like an episode on PBS. Like it was part of like a natural history.
Oh my God, I love it.
Series.
As someone who was bottle fed PBS, yeah, I love exactly. this.
And a woman named Leanne Weberg, who works at the Smithsonian, who knew the crafts when they were alive, talked about how they would often actually go and give talks at like nursing homes to get funding for a lot of these trips.
Wait, did like the nursing home pay them to come and talk to people?
No, I think they just funding? Came and talked to people because apparently old people were interested in volcanoes.
Aww.
Yeah.
Well, they all survived the worst volcanoes. Yeah, exactly. They were there for They were there for fucking Mount Vesuvius. They remember. Hashtag never forget.
Exactly. So Katya and Maurice would often travel like lightly, like more lightly than you think they would, particularly in terms of personal items. They would prefer to reserve most of their suitcase space for gear.
Mm-hmm.
So Leanne, who I mentioned, said, quote, they would go to the Goodwill stores in the U.S., particularly when they would land at, like, view U.S. volcanoes, particularly, like, in Hawaii. Because if a volcano erupted, they couldn't go back to France. They couldn't go to wherever they were going to go get their stuff. So they would just pick up whatever, like, clothing they needed when they got to wherever they were going. Because basically all they would take is one suitcase that was their hot suits, which was one suitcase in its entirety.
Yep.
And like their cameras and stuff, and that would be it. Any additional supplies they needed if they were going to be on a longer trip, they would ship from France to wherever they were because they wanted to get there while it was erupting as soon as possible.
I actually kind of love the idea of this volcanologist power couple hitting up the local Goodwill. Like they just got off the plane. They're like, we got to hit up Goodwill. It's raining. I need my raincoat.
Yeah. They wouldn't travel with any extra luxuries and basically almost no extra clothing. They would just pick up whatever they needed when they got where they were going.
That's awesome. They had so many like unbelievable t-shirts, some like Tampa Bay, Florida, weird sports teams that they never heard of. There was a lot. Oh my God. Imagine all of the Bachelor and Bachelorette shirts that got donated.
1,000%.
Like
Bridget's- and I really hope they just recycled them, meaning like when they would leave, they would just drop them back off at Goodwill and then get on the plane.
Yeah, yeah. Bridget's a bitch who's getting married. Yeah, exactly. 1973. And then they're like,
who's Bridget? I don't fucking know.
I don't know, some bitch who got married in 1973. Right. I don't fucking know.
So yeah, the episode the Crafts were on PBS was a series called Nature. And they were on an episode in the sixth season titled The Volcano Watchers.
I love it.
So one of their final projects was a series of informational films and educational materials all under the title of Understanding Volcanic Hazards and Reducing Volcanic Risks, which was, yeah, particularly designed for people living in volcano splash zones, so to speak, living in or on or around volcanoes.
It's not like SeaWorld where you want to be in exactly. the splash zone. It is, you want to be as far away from the splash zone and still have your superheated spacesuit. Exactly.
So on June 3rd, 1991, at 4 p.m. local time, Mount Unzen erupted.
I was like, okay, you're stressing me out. I don't like this. I don't like the words you're saying.
She's getting too specific.
She's getting so specific, and I hate it.
So this is a volcano near the city of Shimabara, Nagasaki, on the island of Kushi in Japan's southernmost main island. This is a Japanese volcano.
Oh, I think that is the island that Kyushu. Is it Kyushu?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Kyushu. Yeah. The Kyoshi Island from Avatar: The Last Airbender. Yep. That's what that's based off of.
Yep. So, anyways, Mount Unzen erupted, forming pyroclastic flows. So, for people who don't know volcanoes very well, there's lava that comes out of volcanoes, which is that hot, molten rock, essentially. But pyroclastic flows, also known as pyroclastic density or pyroclastic clouds, they tend to be fast-moving currents of hot gases, volcanic matter, such as rock, except, like, anything really coming out of a volcano, that flow along the grounds away from volcanoes at an average speed of about 60 miles per hour. These flows are capable of reaching speeds of up to 430 miles per hour.
And that's what happened at Pompeii.
Yep. Pyroclastic flows are much more dangerous than lava flows.
Because they move more quickly and they can suffocate
and
you.
And they're much more unpredictable. They come, like, because lava you can kind of predict. It's significantly slower moving. You can definitely see it coming. And pyroclastic flows are a lot of times formed from volcanoes that have some sort of, like, dome structure that then either burst or collapse or something that then explodes outward unexpectedly.
Okay.
Yes. Pyroclastic flows are known, if you like look them up, they're kind of known to be basically the most dangerous part of volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, pyroclastic flows range from anywhere from 60 miles per hour to 430. And these gases and debris can reach temperatures of around 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's hot and fast moving.
Mm-hmm.
Like melt your bones hot.
Mm-hmm. So like I said, make your skull explode hot.
Pyroclastic flows are considered the most deadly of all volcanic hazards. So when Mount Unzen erupted, it had a pyroclastic flow that rushed down its slopes, killing 41 people, including the Crafts, as well as their fellow volcanologist, Harry Glicken, who had accompanied them to observe this eruption.
Damn it! I was so worried that that was what was going to happen and that's how they were going to not be here anymore. And I was just really hoping, Kelly, you would love me enough to not do this to me.
Their bodies would be found Fuck. 2 days later.
Fuck!
Katya and Maurice were found near their rental car, lying side by side under a layer of ash. While Harry's body was located nearby, it appeared as though Harry was attempting to flee while Katya and Maurice had remained where they were.
They knew.
They knew, and they were probably just like, well, there's nothing we can do.
They knew. Oh, my God.
All the bodies were burned beyond recognition and were identified using personal items such as watches and cameras.
Oh, my God.
The crafts had filmed the approaching flow, but it was destroyed due to the heat. However, there was a different camera that was found, that had been found in the general vicinity of the eruption. And in 2005, they were able to recover some of the data from that.
Oh, my God.
But it wasn't from Katia Maurice Harry, but it was of the eruption.
Still, that is. Well, and the idea that they were probably filming it.
They definitely were, to the very last second. So Ken Hahn, who was a scientist in charge of the United States Geological Surveys of the Hawaiian volcanoes, who knew the crafts very well because they would often come to Hawaii, first stated that while a lot of their photos and videos look like they're not being cautious, the crafts were extremely cautious. Yeah. It was very much like they knew where to position the camera to make it look a lot more dangerous than it was. And he said specifically after their deaths, quote, the kind of eruption that got them on Unzen, the dome forming eruptions that collapses with small explosions and things, those are the most dangerous kinds of eruptions because they're so unpredictable, is what he, like, specifically what he said.
Yeah.
And he even said, like, he's like, the crafts weren't people that were just going to go risk their lives. Like, they weren't daredevils. They were people that genuinely enjoyed looking at volcanoes, but they did it as safely as possible.
Well, it's like, you know, when you hear someone who has a wild animal as a pet and something bad happens, you're kind of like, what the fuck did you think was going to happen? And I like that he's correcting anyone who might think that, well, they were playing with fire this whole time. This was inevitable.
If you look at their videos, like, you're like, clearly, like, they were just begging for death. It's like, no, they were as cautious as you can be when working around volcanoes. And this particular type of eruption is unpredictable. There's nothing they could have done.
Well, and there, you can't drive away from that. You can't duck and cover. You can't get to higher ground.
Even getting in the car, you're still going to be roasted alive in your car then.
It's just, you see it coming and it's over.
Exactly.
And they knew.
It's moving too fast.
Oh my God, but they were together.
Yeah.
That's so sad though. Like,
the remains that were found of the crafts were cremated and were placed at the Onyoji Shrine in Shimabara, which was dedicated to the victims of the Unzen earthquake and tsunami that happened after the volcanic eruption.
Oh, God, of course there was a fucking tsunami after. Duh.
Afterward, their ashes were interred in Katia's family plot in France. So their ashes are in France. Legacy. So afterward, there is a crater named the M&K Craft Crater on the Piton de la Fournaise volcano in Réunion, France, obviously named after the couple. There is several like medals of honor, whether it's in Katia or both of their names. One is awarded every 4 years by the International Association of Volcanology and Chemistry of the Earth's Interior, which I was like, Jesus Christ, that's a long name. So that one is specifically to someone who has made significant contributions to volcanology through service to communities affected by volcanic activity specifically.
Yeah.
Which was very much what Katia was all about.
Well, because she wasn't just like, ooh, you know,
like,
look
she's
at
like,
that.
Ooh, volcanoes are cool, but like, ooh, volcanoes are cool. How do we keep the people living near them safe?
Well, because when you think of like, okay, I think Vesuvius and Pompeii is the volcano, other than maybe Mount St. Helens in North America, that we all learned about as kids. That, you know, that's kind of one of your first and foremost volcano education pieces. People are still living right around that volcano. It is active. It could go off, and Hawaii is a volcano.
It just recently erupted, yeah.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? It's like, you can say, like, well, why would you live there? But first of all, I'm sorry, we are so populated, we don't get to be that picky. But also, you know, there is a way to be smart about those things, and you know,
yeah, it's like, what signs do we watch for? How do we know? When do we need to evacuate?
There are some natural disasters that we can't predict accurately, like maybe an earthquake, especially in an area with great seismic activity because they're always having like little tremors. And any of those little tremors could be a sign of the big one or just normal, you know? But with volcanoes, you can kind of track that and be like, okay, we gotta take it back. Because Mount St. Helens,
oh yeah,
they knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And actually, as many people that died or got hurt, they didn't need to.
No. Yeah. So the Center for the Study of Active Volcanoes, based in Hawaii, in Hilo, Hawaii specifically, has established a fund remembering the crafts. It's the Maurice and Katia Memorial Fund. And donations to this are directed to educate people in countries of high volcanic risk about the hazards of active volcanoes. So, like, all of these funds or all of these memorials dedicated to them is very much about, like, helping the people that are going to be affected by the volcanoes, what their research did.
I love that. Oh, my God.
So the craft's up-close footage of volcanic eruptions has been attributed to enhancing geologists' understanding about volcanoes, about how they worked. Like, the fact that they were getting closer than anyone else at the time. I mean, the fact that they were even on the ground when these volcanoes were erupting, when most people were waiting until they were done erupting to show up, just helped change how people were studying volcanoes in general, particularly Katia. She has been cited as a pioneer. The source I read, I got really annoyed. I got kind of mad because they were like, in the field of female volcanologists. But no, she was one of the only, like, I mean, her husband was too, but like, even when she wasn't around, she was one of the only people that were like, no, I'm getting my boots on the ground. I'm going to get as close as humanly possible to get these readings, to get these samples, to be able to write about it, to be able to help people.
Also, female volcanology is
volcanologists.
It's not a separate field of study. It's not you're studying female volcanoes. Like, she is a pioneer for women in STEM and women 100%. In volcanology, but she is a preeminent volcanologist, full stop.
Exactly. She was one of the first female volcanologists in general.
Yep.
I will note that. And she's been a huge inspiration for other women that want to follow in her footsteps. So one article I was reading talked about a female volcanologist named Janine Krippner, who's currently a volcanologist based in New Zealand, who wanted to be a volcanologist since she was 13 and she learned about Katia. And she's like, Katia was the one that, like, gave me the courage. Like, finding out that there was already women doing this, even if they did die in the pursuit of it, gave me the courage to pursue what I wanted.
And I just gotta say, that's a bad bitch who's like, oh, my hero died doing this. Oh, God, I'm gonna do it anyway. Like you've read the full book. You know how it ends, and you're still, like, very inspired.
Right.
I'd be like, oh, maybe I'm gonna, like, pursue it different. But that's why I'm not a volcanologist.
Right. So in 2022, there was a documentary released called Fire of Love. It's a documentary made by a woman named Sarah Dosa. It was created during the pandemic.
Yeah.
But it was because Sarah learned about Katia and Maurice and then, like, found out, like, hey, there's still a lot of their footage that's just, like, out there. Maurice's older brother had it, and then it was, like, in trust and all this different stuff. And she went and she watched all of this footage, all of these interviews, all of these things. And she put together a documentary that isn't like a talking head documentary, because obviously Maurice and Katia are dead. But it's about their work, and it's a mixture of, like, clips that they had taken, clips of them being on different news shows, clips of them, like, just various things, really just showing, like I said, this love triangle between Katia, Maurice, and volcanoes. And there are a few sections that are, like, newer film of volcanoes, mm-hmm. but almost all of it is Katia and Maurice's filming.
It's kind of them getting to tell their own story posthumously.
Right. Exactly. And there is someone that, like, narrates it and stuff mm-hmm. like that, but it is, like, just, I haven't gotten to watch it yet, but it's supposed to be this, like, incredibly powerful documentary. Like, a lot of the footage is shitty because it's from the 1970s and 1980s, but the Sarah who made it was like, I didn't want to enhance it because that, like, ruins the quality of what Maurice and Katia were doing.
Also, we grew up on that shit.
Exactly.
I think we can handle it.
So yeah, this documentary is not just supposed to be about their time in the field. It's not just supposed to be about volcanoes, but it's supposed to be about them as people, as individuals, and their marriage. And Sarah talked about, yeah, like I said, she's the one that described it as a love triangle between Maurice Katia and volcanoes. And yeah, like I said, it's called Fire of Love. It's on Hulu and Disney Plus.
Oh, shit.
And stuff like that. So it's like, it's out there. It's still out
there.
Oh, my
God.
It was released in 2022. It's still out there. I haven't watched it yet. I want to watch it. It's received several nominations. I don't think it's like won anything.
Shit,
but it's supposed, like, is it going to be like the best film you've ever watched? Probably not. Is it a really good documentary about volcanoes and these two people who loved them and loved each other? Yes.
As opposed to the many, many, many other documentaries about them in recent years. Like, seriously, I want to watch that.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
And I think it's so cool that they didn't try to like recreate their lives with like actors. They were like, no, like we're going to use this not the best footage for 2022, but it's them. It's genuinely them. And apparently just from a lot of the reading I did, like it does. It really just shows through like how goofy they were, how they interacted with one another. And then it's intercut with these interviews, like the interview I mentioned earlier of like, seeing like they didn't include the one of like Katia like and that sexism where she just like tenses, but like other interviews with them about like their work and their like passion and all of this stuff. And so yeah, I would recommend going to watch The Fire of Love, just because yeah, it is like it's going to give you a different side of the picture than I can give you, because I don't have like, this is not a multimedia presentation. But yeah, that is Katia Kraft.
So
and Maurice.
I'm a little angry with you right now because before we started this segment, Kelly and I were both feeling kind of punchy and upset about something. And I was like gearing up to do this. And I was like, Kelly, do you have Nazis in your story? She says, nope. I'm like, that's all I need. I can get through this. We're good. Let's do it. I'm excited. There were no Nazis, but God damn it, Kelly. She's like, I'm not lying, but I'm going to devastate you in another way that you can't predict handle.
There was that like little bit in the back that's like, they do die by volcano, very tragically, but I'm not going to mention that.
I should have seen the twinkle in your eye, but I just didn't even want to look.
And it's like, it's one of those things that it's like, I don't want to shy away from telling these stories that have unhappy endings.
No, of course not.
Yes, there's this documentary out there that's very recent, but I had still never heard of Katia.
No, and I love volcanoes. I love that
shit.
So
do I.
Oh, like, my God.
They're devastating and terrible and horrible, but, like, they're fucking interesting.
They're so... Any extreme, I think, is very fascinating for us as people to explore.
And I love that they took this love and this fascination with this terrible thing that nature has created and turned it into, like... We're going to do as much research as possible to find out, one, the benefits that can come after this horrible disaster, but two, how do we help and save as many people as we can from these things? And that people have continued their legacy afterward.
I will say, out of the two scientific power couples, I think mine offered the best field trip prospect. Yeah. I don't know if I want to recreate any of these
definitely
field trips.
Still want to go to a volcano, but maybe not an active volcano.
No. Yeah.
I will go to either an extinct one that definitely isn't going to erupt, or one that they're like, no, we're monitoring it and it's fine.
Yeah.
Maybe that's actually the one I would prefer, because like,
you keep an eye on those bitches.
Exactly, because there is the chance, like in Katia's story, there is a chance that extinct volcanoes can erupt again. Very slim. Very, very slim. Almost never happens. But I'm like, I would almost prefer to go to a volcano that has previously been active recent enough that is not considered extinct, but they are still monitoring so they know when it erupts again and know it's not going to be in the, like, 10-day window that I'm going to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. I can.
Because I would love to, like, go to Hawaii and see the volcano, or I would love to go to Italy and see one of their four volcanoes. You know, like, there are places I would like to go. I don't know if I'd want to necessarily go to Japan to see the one that, like, Katia and Maurice died on, but kind of at the same time.
Or we could go to Central Wisconsin for the Prairie Chicken Festival.
I mean,
and watch those little boomers, those little inbred boomers.
You know, they're not mutually exclusive, Emily.
Maybe there's a volcano in Wisconsin with boomers all over it.
I mean, there is a lot of like, there is a lot to say if you look at like the faults. Like, a lot of people consider Yellowstone.
We don't have to talk about that.
A volcano?
We don't have to talk about that.
And that fault line lies under Minnesota and Wisconsin.
We do not have to talk about it.
Okay.
We don't
Emily,
need to.
What are you thankful for then?
You know, you're stirring up the doomsday paranoia. Every time I watch a documentary like that as a kid, I'm like, oh, that's how I'm going to die. Yeah. My state's just going to blow up.
I mean, at least like it's one of those things that's like, you're gone. Like, you don't even have to think about it. You're just gone. You're dust. It's not even a choice you get to make. You're just gone.
I am choking on the metaphorical dust of your death scenario.
Of my death, specifically.
Thanks. Of your scenario of my death. Your I mean, death hyphen like, scenario.
Like everyone in yeah. Minnesota.
Oh, my God.
Honestly, like, I've looked into that because it is interesting. And it is true. There is a fault line that lies under Minnesota. But the chances of that happening are so astronomically tiny that it's probably never going to happen.
Kelly, let me introduce you to my string of luck.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not great.
I mean, there's Kurt. He's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
I feel like your luck's turning around.
Don't worry. That'll blow up in my face
no,
eventually.
No, it won't. Shut up. Think positively.
I mean, I did throw up in his car and he still dates
loves
me.
You.
He still dates me. So that's a thing. That's cool. Other than the fact that my boyfriend didn't dump me after I threw up in his car.
You know, valid.
In my credit, I caught it all in my coat. None of it got
exactly,
in his
like,
car.
You were very, very respectful and were like, I'm not gonna throw up on your car. I'm gonna throw up in your car, but on my own shit.
I'm a very considerate vomiteer.
Good.
I guess there's a lot of stuff I'm thankful for. I'm thankful that the live show went well. We had some really good questions and some really good engagement from people who we didn't guilt into coming.
And like follow up from some of them too. Like, holy shit.
It was amazing. And I'm so thankful for that. I also got a phone call today. I told Kelly about it. I won't go into detail, but it was one of those things where it put some things in perspective for me that I've been really hard on myself about. And I'm like, first of all, it could be worse. But second of all, at no point, like, it was about leaving a bad relationship. And at no point do you ever not celebrate that? At no point do you ever go, oh, I should have left sooner. Oh, I should, if I left at this point, I'm so stupid. No, you don't do that. You know, you celebrate the fact that
you're out
and you're on to better things. And that was really cool.
Good.
And it came out of fucking nowhere. Like,
it was one of those things that you're like, we're not expecting it at all.
Absolutely nowhere. Yeah. And I was just like, oh shit, the universe just sent me a message, and I am listening.
Thanks, universe.
Kelly, what are you thankful for?
I feel like shitty for following like my thankful for up after your thankful for. I should like for like
see
the first time ever. I'm like I should have gone first.
Yep. See, I'm just doing you a favor when I ask you first.
By the time this episode releases, it's gonna be well past my birthday. Because theoretically, we're gonna release our live episode first, and then this one, I think. But I'm just really thankful for everyone that's celebrating my birthday with me. Like my workmates decorated my office, which was very awkward to explain to some of my
God,
clients.
That's so cute.
Because they were like, what's with the streamers? And I'm like, don't worry about it.
It wasn't my choice.
No, but I really did appreciate it. And we actually had like three birthdays in a row. So that was very intense. A lot of streamers going around. It was kind of funny because I just like moved from one office to the other. It was
this
very funny.
This is birthday time. Birthday time.
I'm just really appreciative for the love and the care and the compassion and the acknowledgement of my existence and the appreciation people are showing me for being here because I don't always feel like people want me here. I don't always feel great to be around. And I'm not saying people need to like appreciate me every day, but it does feel nice to be appreciative, and I am appreciative of that appreciation.
First of all, people do appreciate you being around every goddamn day. Second of all, I hope you understand that your feelings of people don't want to be around me or I'm not great to feel around are in fact, your feelings exactly. and not reflective of us. Don't you put that evil on me, Ricky Bobby. Don't you put that nice. Evil on me.
Nice callback film quote there.
I watched it recently and I was like, this is still so good. It's so fucking funny. Anyway. Oh, and that actor died too.
I know.
Oh, it made myself sad again. Damn it.
It was all on you that time.
I know. Emily got confused Emily got so and injured derailed, herself. Yeah. It's like a Pokemon. Emily got confused and hurt herself.
Yeah, there you go.
But I mean, I know all of our listeners appreciate you. I know I appreciate the hell out of you. I know every single person in your life is so thankful for you. And even when you don't feel that you're at your best, we are just so thankful that you allow us into your lives, because that is that's a privilege you're giving us. Or in my case, you know, I have forced my way in and clamped on like the parasite I am.
She just keeps showing up every 2 weeks and I don't know what to do.
After every single episode, Kelly's like, we're not doing the podcast anymore. And then I show up.
2 weeks later, I'm like, God damn it. I guess I still have some wine left.
And somehow Kelly always has her stories ready. So really, who's at fault here? Who's asking for it? But no, I mean, Kelly, we love you. I love you. And I'm so thankful for you.
I love you too. And I'm thankful for you as well.
And I'm thankful you're old. I am like old. Me.
I was like, you're older.
Like me. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Wine About Herstory, where Emily jokes about how old Kelly is, even though she is way older.
Like less than a month.
Like us on Facebook at Whining About Herstory, Instagram at WAHPAD.
Our website is whiningaboutherstory.com, where you can find a link to all of our social medias, as well as our sweet-ass merch. You can also find a link to our Patreon, where you can listen to as little as $1. We're going to start doing more live things, and by more, I mean like maybe once a quarter. We'll see. We'll see how interested people are.
Had our first Patreon happy hour, and it was awesome. There was drinking and merriment to be had by all in attendance.
Fun. It was very, very
nice. More people showed up than I thought would.
Yeah, same, actually. We're not going to talk about it. Anyways, but seriously, join our Patreon. There's bonus episodes on different things as well as you get a discount on merch. Hopefully new merch coming soon. I got some ideas.
I also have ideas. I was thinking about something on the drive home today. Nice.
Buy me a coffee for as little as $5, one-time payment, where you can buy us a bottle of wine, where we'll pick up a wine that you recommend or is somehow loosely related to your name or where you're from.
Canadian king lion holding a maple leaf. Yeah,
depending on how much we know about you.
Intimately we're familiar. Know what else to do.
Please rate us 5 stars wherever you listen.
It pisses off the patriarchy.
And it gives us warm, fuzzy feelings.
Every time you raise 5 stars, Donald Trump's dick grows a little smaller.
It's basically invisible now.
You know, it's one of those things where you take something.
Just start receding.
And when you divide it in half, you can never get to zero. But yeah. You can get like absurdly small.
You can get to the naked eye can no longer see it.
Yes. Make that dick small again.
Always.
I mean, I don't think. You know what? I'm not even going to attack his penis.
Because he sucks
as a human being. He sucks. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
Have an empowered day, y'all. Bye.